From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack.
And I'm host Evan Dawson. It's kind of weird saying the host, by the way. I guess I am the host.
It's weird saying producer,
I know,
too.
No.
Maybe by this time everybody knows who
Megan
we are.
Megan and Evan. Yeah, we should kind of just do it like that. We're going to open with a talk about photography. We had a very, to me, very compelling discussion about the power of photojournalism these days. And before we get into the really kind of heavier stuff, did you see the Usain Bolt picture that we talked about on the show as well? The picture of Usain Bolt right at the finish line, turning to the other racers as he crossed and won the 100 meters.
I didn't know.
Oh my gosh, and you're an Olympics person.
I know.
It's this incredible picture, and trust me, if you have not seen it, check it out.
Was he doing the lightning pose?
No. This is like right as he's crossing the finish line. But as he's crossing the finish line, he is turning to the other racers and he is smiling.
Oh.
As if to say, you will never catch me. And they are not smiling. They are grimacing in the pain of not being Usain Bolt.
But did you see the photo of him and Andre DeGrasse in the qualifying round?
Yeah,
they're just kind of having a great time.
I love that. I really, really like him. I think some people think he's a bit of a showman. I think he is a showman, but he's that good. I also don't think he's disrespectful. I just think he's having fun. But this photograph was amazing because it took a professional photographer to get the exact right spot and moment. And for all the images of Usain Bolt, and there are millions, it took this professional photographer to create the iconic shot. And that, to me, was just a reminder, we still need professional photographers. And we're going to open with a focus on a photo that has also caught the world's attention, but certainly of a different subject. It shows a 5-year-old Syrian boy named Omran Dakhnish covered in dust and blood in the back of an ambulance. The building in which his family lives had just been bombed. Omran looks stunned, emotionless, and alone.
We talked about the power of photojournalism, and despite cuts in newsrooms, photojournalists still produce work that can spark change. In this clip, you'll hear Democrat and Chronicle lead photographer Max Schulze, 4-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer William Snyder, and former White House deputy photo editor Jen Poggi. They're addressing the question, of all the images of child suffering, why did the photo of Omran go viral?
As a parent, if you have children, you can't help but look at this image and think, what if that was my child? And I think that's probably the connection that people are making with this photo, is that people who, you know, have raised their children or have children are looking into this kid's eyes and making a connection, and they're feeling something that they haven't felt from the other ones. And that's probably what has sparked this image to be somewhat the iconic image out of this right now.
Yeah. William, what do you think?
Well, I think if you look at sort of like both of those images, the child on the beach and this one, they're very simple images. There's nothing else distracting you to your attention. You're focused on that child. And in this particular instance, you have nothing to look at really but their eyes to begin with. And so at his eyes. And I think that connection, same thing with the beach. You know, you look at the child's face and, you know, you're there. You don't have destroyed backgrounds. You don't have lots of other people. You're just focused in on this one child. And I think it's the simplicity of the image that makes it so powerful. Plus, you know, it moved around social media really fast before the mainstream media got their hands on it. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps with it, too.
Jen, what do you think?
I would echo what William has to say about its simplicity. I think that some of the most powerful images that resonate with the public are images that are otherwise mundane situations. Not to say that the situation in Aleppo is in any way mundane, yet the simplicity of the boy in the back of this ambulance is a scenario that we could somehow imagine ourselves being in, and the horror, and, you know, we can relate in some way or imagine ourselves in some way in that particular set of circumstances. I also think that the video that accompanied that image,
yep,
is a crucial part of this particular image because, you know, we see, especially on social media, but also in the articles that have been written, we see that accompanying the still image. And so we see the boy's movement. We see how disoriented he is. And I think that adds, you know, he's quiet and there's the quiet sense about him, you know, really portrays the shock that we imagine him to be going through. People have commented about the way he wipes the dust and blood off next to him. It's sort of a matter of factly, and I think that's very powerful. It resonates.
Next, we sat down with investigative journalist David K. Johnston, who has a new book out. It's called The Making of Donald Trump. Johnston has been covering Trump closely since the 1980s.
Johnston used his previous digging along with some new research to paint a picture of Donald Trump. It is not a flattering one. Johnston describes Trump's obsession with revenge, his secrecy about his finances, his desire for control. In fact, Johnston told us that back in April, before the book was done, Trump called him at his Brighton home to complain about it. Here's how Johnston sums up Trump and his career.
If people read my book and then say, I still want this guy to be president, then vote for him. But at least know that you're voting for a man who has no moral core, who lies the way people breathe, who takes pleasure in destroying the lives of other people, who calls himself a Christian and yet espouses a philosophy that is aggressively anti-Christian.
And that's the philosophy of revenge and hurting people.
Revenge and hurting people. That's exactly right. And who we now know from the work the New York Times did yesterday is deeply in debt to banks in China, which all of which are either owned fully or partly by the government. So that means the nine thugs who run China, the Politburo, they're in Donald Trump's pockets. We know that Russian oligarchs have paid money to Trump, bought properties from Trump, and I've shown that there's a what appears to be a $250 million tax fraud that Trump is currently only a material witness in, that he had to approve the actions that led to this tax fraud. That leads back to Russian oligarchs. And a few days ago, there was a terrific investigative piece in the New York Times about Vladimir Putin murdering people. We've known he's done this for years, and I discovered to my amazement the Duma passed a law that allows him to murder people as long as they're outside of Russia. So here we have a presidential candidate putting forth the major foreign policy objective of the leader in Russia, which is to destroy or weaken NATO, and who has financial entanglements with the oligarchs in Russia. And you're either with Putin in Russia as an oligarch or you're in jail or dead, and who has huge borrowings, hundreds of millions of dollars of borrowings that put him in hock to the Chinese government, which he keeps attacking. This is just beyond, if you'd written this as a novel, even 15 years ago, nobody would have believed it. I could just, you know, see editors at houses writing back saying, this story is beyond belief. No one would accept the reality of this. It's here.
And now for a very different kind of person, a man who worked his way up in the world of New York City finance and had a stake in a successful hedge fund. David Ryder is a Buffalo native, and needless to say, he was making a lot of money. But he was not happy. And so despite having set himself up for a career making many millions of dollars, he walked away to the seminary.
Ryder is now building his own church in Rochester called the Flower City Church. Here he is explaining why he felt his work in the hedge fund was hurting his soul.
The firm didn't do well the first show I was there. And, you know, I was new to the industry, and one of the guys that had been around for a while took me out for it. We went out to a bar across the street, had a glass of bourbon, and he looked at me and he just said, you know, this is the worst time for us in this industry because what we do, it's not like painting a fence. You can't look back at the end of the day and say, hey, this is what I built. This is what I did. This is what I worked on. This is what's there. We just bet and we either make money or we don't. And so in a year when we don't make money, we just look back at the year and felt like we just wasted an entire year and didn't accomplish anything. And so that's a way of thinking of what are you really doing here? You're just kind of generating trades and moving pieces of paper around. And so that carried forward for me in a way that it didn't necessarily for him, which was even in a year we do make money, that's all we've done. We haven't really, I didn't feel like I was doing something enduring. And this is where we want to be careful because I do value a lot of the people I worked with, people who invest and are contributing towards people's retirement system and enabling them to retire through the investments. I mean, the whole industry exists so that good ideas can be brought to market and can go to business. And so there's good things happening. But for me, when I looked at it, exactly what you said, even if a deal went the right way and we made a bunch of money, it was then a bunch of knowledge for me that was discarded. It was kind of short-term knowledge. It was fleeting, ephemeral. We didn't have something that was enduring. And I don't feel that way in currently what I'm doing. I feel like the work we're doing now is enduring. Whether it's studying a scripture passage for preaching, the sermon might be over, but that knowledge, that whatever wisdom has come from that, whatever new revelations I've learned about myself, about the world, about others, about how to serve, is enduring and applicable in a number of ways going forward that continues. And so there's this kind of enduring nature versus a fleeting nature of how you're spending your time and where you're directing your energy and resources.
And so you end up leaving that industry in 2007, right when the crash is starting. And
yeah, it was too bad.
And I saw you smile a little bit when Keith mentioned The Big Short. But I do think it's important to establish whether you think, even if it's not the norm or the majority, if you do feel that Wall Street occasionally isn't just helping people's retirement systems and helping people retire earlier, that there is a creation of instruments for the purpose of short-term gain that really does imperil the system, that is imperiling 401ks, and has the potential to hurt people based on avarice.
I'll set the movie aside for a second and go to the book, because Michael Lewis is an excellent writer, and I think he nails it. He actually nails it in Liar's Poker, which I think is his first book.
And I think that goes back to the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. And what he saw was that the industry changed when these banks became public, and especially now that they're too big to fail, or deemed too big to fail. I don't know if they really should be, but they're deemed too big to fail. What you're doing is you have a lot of incentive built in to take chances and to take undue risk, because you don't have, you're not going to pay the price if it all goes down. If it was a tightly held partnership, and this is what he talked about with Salomon Brothers and his history there, in a tightly held partnership, the partners would never let you be leveraged 50-1. I mean, I think of long-term capital management, even going before The Big Short, never would have allowed that kind of leverage, because they would have gone bankrupt. Whereas if it's shareholders that are just going to lose a bunch of money, whoever they are, or the government's going to bail them out so even they don't get hammered that badly, you know, then you have a situation where there's all upside. If I can make, and typically in a hedge fund, you keep 20% of your profit. So if I can keep 20% of every dollar I make, and I'm going to lose $0 for every dollar I lose, of course I'm going to take on a ton of risk. And so it's structured in such a way to encourage that kind of behavior.
Finally this week, let's turn to climate change. There's a proposal making the rounds, and supporters say this is the kind of legislation that can both slow down global warming and improve the economy. It's called a carbon fee and dividend. Here's how it works. Carbon producers are taxed on the amount of carbon. Then the government takes that money and gives it back to taxpayers in the form of a monthly check.
The Citizens Climate Lobby argues that this proposal can appeal to liberals and conservatives and everyone in between. We talked to National Director Mark Reynolds, as well as members of the Rochester chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby.
What a study actually showed is if you only give people the problems related to climate change, it actually hurts more often than it helps. But if you offer a solution, it tends to bring people along. So I think that that's been really attractive for a lot of people. And also because we're the kind of organization, you know, David Brooks had another great piece in the Times today where he talked about, you know, there's a big difference between what brings people to Congress rather than what happens to them once they are in Congress. And I think our people are always going in and reminding members of Congress what brought them there, not the difficult things that they have to deal with once they get there. And I think that people like appealing to what is big in people.
In studio, I want to ask Abby McHugh-Griffa, who's the co-leader of the local chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. CCL locally is how big now? How many members, and how do you compare that? What kind of growth have you seen?
So we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 very active volunteers, but we have over 400 people on our mailing list. So, you know, we're getting the word out, and we're a presence in the community, definitely. We table at a lot of events. We are certainly meeting with members of Congress. We've had letters to the editor published in the DNC. So we're getting the word out. But about 20 very committed volunteers.
We've had over 1,000 postcards signed by individuals to our various representatives indicating the need for federal climate change legislation.
This can very much be a conservative solution. It can be a progressive solution. It can be both. It can be worked together here. How do you frame these discussions about our planet and climate change solutions?
Yeah. So to me, it's a fundamental opportunity for reflection on each of our parts. And I'm talking about all of us. All of us now talking and discussing and listening, and as you were mentioning, Republicans, Democrats, gay, straight, young, old.
Greens, libertarians.
Absolutely, seriously, in all manner and form. The two questions I think are critical are to ask ourselves individually is simply this. One is, what do we have in common? What do we have in common? And then secondly, what is it that we love? What do we love? So if we begin to get a hold of what comes out of the heart, what comes out of our guts in terms of each of these responses, I think we begin to have something to work with in terms of a way to engage each other, in terms of a way of talking that is without polemics, without, as we were talking earlier, this vilifying, this demonizing of people with different ideas. So those are the two questions. What is it that we have in common that we can each ask ourselves as individuals? And what is it that each of us loves? Let's start there.
And that does it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can join us for Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
You can also find us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Have a wonderful weekend.